Good morning, everyone. Good to see you all once again. Hebrews 11 is called the faith chapter, and for obvious reasons, because it has not only the definition of faith, but many very good examples of faith, shining examples of faith. Hebrews 11 and verse 1 tells us what faith is. It says, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for." I'm reading from the New American Standard Bible because I believe the definition here is a little clearer than the old King James Version, and this brings out what the writer originally intended. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. In other words, we hope for such things as the coming kingdom of God. We can't see it, we can't touch it, we read about it, we know it is coming. So the assurance that it is coming, the conviction that we're going to be a part of it, that's faith. Or this applies, of course, to any of the promises of God. And as the writer of the book of Hebrews, once he defines faith, then he goes on to give several prime examples. And if anyone, I believe, who is a student of the Old Testament, not necessarily an advanced student of the Old Testament, but one who just simply reads the text, would not be surprised by the examples that he uses. For example, there in verse 4, he mentions Abel. And back in the Old Testament, we're told that Abel walked with God. Obviously, he was a man of faith. And then he mentions Enoch in verse 5. I'm sorry, Enoch is the one who walked with God. Abel was the one who offered the correct offering, as opposed to Cain, his brother. And the proper offering was an expression of belief, an expression of faith. And then it was Enoch who walked with God, and God took him, and he was not. So these are examples of faith that certainly are not surprising to any student of the Old Testament, and probably examples, if you were writing this chapter, that you would use yourself. Then there's the example of Noah. Obviously, he has to be in there. And no question about it, in verse 8, Abraham, the prime example of faith. And he's mentioned more than once here, and later on, the writer comes back to this example and shows many things that Abraham did, which were acts of faith, acts of this conviction that he had, this assurance that he had of the promises that God had given him. And then, of course, Isaac and Jacob are mentioned. Sarah is also mentioned as an example of faith. Now, that's one that perhaps would have slipped by me, because usually when you think in terms of faith and you're reading the story of Abraham, somehow Sarah and other people associated with him kind of slip by. But here she's listed as an example of faith. We read in verse 13, "All these died in faith without receiving the promises." Now, the promises he's talking about, of course, are the promises given in the Abrahamic covenant, or the Abrahamic promises that you read about in Genesis, the 12th chapter. These died not having received the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. One such example of confession is in Genesis 23 and verse 4, where Abraham confessed to the people living in the land, and Abraham was very old at this point. His wife Sarah had died, and he confessed to them that I am a stranger and a sojourner among you, meaning he was a resident alien. He did not inherit the land. Now, he was there and had been there for many, many years because God had told him that this land will be yours. And now there he is. His wife is now dead. He needs a place to bury her. And he's still calling himself a stranger and a sojourner. And the writer goes on to say, "For those who say such things make it clear that they're seeking a country of their own." In other words, Abraham is still believing that he'll have this country. But now here he is at a ripe old age, and God has already told him that he was going to die in a good old age. Yet, here he is, still believing. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, if they'd been thinking of Ur, of the Chaldees, or as far as that goes, Egypt, or wherever it might have been, they would have had opportunity to return. But no, he stayed right there, is the point that the writer is making, and showing that Abraham was a man of faith, and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. So they looked for this city, they awaited it, they knew that one day they would inherit it. No matter that they knew that they were going to face death, no matter about that, they knew that ultimately they would enter into that permanent city and inherit that city and live forever. Of course, we're talking about the kingdom of God. He goes on to speak further about the example of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then he speaks of Joseph. And you know, one of the remarkable things about all of these various examples is that you find that expressions of faith do not always come in acts of great, you know, of greatness, acts of great valiant heroism or things of that nature. Sometimes it's just a matter of simply living one's daily life from day to day, as you find here in the example of Joseph. Of course, we know what he had to endure. But it says when he was dying in verse 22, he made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. You know, that's not a great heroic act. It just showed that Joseph believed God's promise that those people would one day go out of Egypt. And he wanted his bones to be taken along with them. So you find many varying examples of faith here. And as I say, not all of them are great heroic deeds that involved risk. Some of them were, some of them were not. But all of them were examples of faith. And of course, the story would not be complete if Moses were not mentioned, obviously. And any student of the Old Testament, if he began to list the heroes of faith, naturally he would have Moses in there. The writer here speaks about the fact that Moses chose to endure the ill treatment with the people of God rather than the pleasures of sin for a passing few moments. And then he goes on down in verse 30. He doesn't mention him by name, but he's speaking of Joshua and no doubt other men, other people associated with him. He says, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. So all of these are perfectly logical examples of faith that most of us would probably have listed if we were writing our own chapter on the people of faith in the Old Testament. But here's one that when I first read this, I kind of stumbled on it a little bit, perhaps because of the stigma that's attached to a title associated with her name. Notice verse 31. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. I used to wonder about that. I've heard people say, well, that's just talking about some kind of superficial faith that applies only to this life, not to salvation necessarily. These others, oh yeah, Abraham will be in the kingdom, Isaac and Jacob will be there, Moses will be there, Joshua will be there, no doubt. These are those few individuals back in the Old Testament period who did have the Holy Spirit and who will be in the kingdom of God. But not this one, not Rahab, not Rahab the harlot. After all, this was a Canaanite woman. She lived in Jericho, which was in central Canaan. But let's take a look at this example today and see that, in fact, this is a remarkable example of faith when you look at the circumstances she was in and see what she was facing and the life she was accustomed to and the people she lived among. And you look at this, you see that really this is quite a remarkable, simple, very simple, but a remarkable example of faith. And she still stands as an example of faith for those of us today. One word about this term harlot. Some expositors claim that it possibly means hostess or tavern keeper, but that's because they have a problem with the term and the fact that Rahab was one of them. Doesn't say she continued to be one throughout her life, but she was one. The thing is, the problem with that is, though, is that as you look through if you do your own word study and you find how this term is used throughout the Hebrew scriptures as well as the Greek, if you check the Septuagint and other sources, you have to take one gigantic etymological leap to make it say anything other than harlot. So it seems that Rahab really was or had been a harlot. You know, it's interesting that here she is a shining example of faith, but I wonder how she'll feel about it when she realizes someday that title, that tag, was still carried on with her throughout the generations. But let's take a look at that example today, because we do find in Rahab an example of faith. Go back with me to Joshua, the book of Joshua. And in chapter 1, we begin reading about how Joshua, having taken over leadership for the people of Israel after Moses, is now commissioned of God to take the people across the river Jordan and into the land of promise. In chapter 2, we read about how Joshua sent spies to Jericho to learn about the land, to see what they were dealing with there before they went in, because this was in central Canaan, and this was the first people or among the first people that they'd have to be dealing with as they took over the land. In chapter 2, in verse 2, "And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, Behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. And the king of Jericho," and by the way, verse 1 tells us this, that the spies went and came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab, and they lodged there. And then the king was told about this, verse 3, "And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land." And of course, they were fearful of these people because they knew about them. They knew what had happened when they came out of Egypt. They knew how God had overthrown Pharaoh and his armies. And the woman had taken the two men and hidden them, and she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark that the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." I'm not going to get into the controversy over whether or not it's all right to lie in a situation like this. We'll leave that one alone. That's for some other study. "But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax which she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords, and as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate. Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land." Now listen to this carefully. This tells us what Rahab already knew. And it also tells us what the other people in Jericho and the cities round about already knew. But keep in mind that because of the mighty acts of God in bringing His people out of Egypt, the word went out, word of this event, and people all over knew about it. That's what God meant when He said, I have gained myself for myself honor in the defeat of Pharaoh. So she said, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you." Because they knew who these people were. Well, these were the people whose God had defeated Egypt. "For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and when what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And when we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath." What she is saying here is really on behalf of all of those people. They all knew this. They all knew it. This is a confession of faith right here. But they all knew it. Now, keep in mind what James said. In talking about the Hebrew Shema, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one," he said, "You believe that God is one? You do well. Ah, but the demons also believe, and they tremble." The same was true of the people of these lands in general. They believed. They had heard about the great God of Israel. And they trembled because they knew what was going to happen to them when the people of God approached their borders. So here you have the same situation. These people, like the demons, were trembling. But this belief, the kind of faith, if you want to call it that, that demons have, really doesn't produce anything. It doesn't produce any change. It doesn't produce any fruit, generally speaking. But we're going to see an example here of one Canaanite lady in whom the fruit was produced because of this knowledge that had gone out, the word that had traveled around, and the knowledge of God now that filled the land. It did produce something in this one example. You know, these people, you might think that God is rather cruel because He's going to send the Israelites into this land to destroy everything. You think, how could a merciful, righteous, and holy God, a God of love, kill everything in sight, even the animals? He said, don't leave anything. Because if you understand the nature, if you understand the culture, then you'll begin to understand why God commanded that. You see, these people were so degenerate, they were actually offering their children, their babies, their infants, as sacrifices to the gods in order to appease the gods, in order to gain favor with the gods. They'd actually gone that far. Rampant prostitution, male and female. Every form of abomination that you can imagine associated with idolatry. And God knew that if these people remained, then the Israelites would soon begin to take up some of their customs. In fact, as they went through the land of Canaan and overcame these various peoples who lived in the land, the various towns and villages and so forth, the truth is that they didn't destroy everything. And they did allow some of those things to remain. And in time, they did adopt some of their customs, and as a result, it brought God's own curse upon those people. But here we have the people approaching and about to overtake Jericho. Here we have the testimony of Rahab. She gives this confession of faith, "For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath." And we see that these people trembled before the living and true God. They knew who He was. Now, they did have other gods, obviously. They had gods of probably the elements, earth, wind, air, so forth, gods of the sky, gods of fertility, gods who blessed the crops, God who brought all kinds of blessings. And in fact, when you read through the law of Moses, you find some of those kind of strange laws, you wonder, what's that about? When in most cases, probably they're dealing with customs that were in these very lands. For example, in the law of Moses, God tells the Israelites not to boil a kid in its mother's milk. Now, what's that about? Well, we now know, due to documents that have been preserved from these very lands, from these people, the Canaanites, the ancient Canaanites, that that was an ancient magical rite of fertility. And God was simply saying, don't adopt those pagan practices. Stay away from them. And so this is the kind of society Rahab was accustomed to. She grew up in this, evidently, assuming that she'd been there all her life. And apparently she had been. And I think by the fact that she's identified as a harlot shows us that she had been affected by her culture, just as all of us are affected by the cultures in which we live to some degree or another. And then it goes on, verse 12, "Now therefore please swear to me by the Lord," Rahab says, "since I have dealt kindly with you, that you also will deal kindly with my father's household and give me a pledge of truth. And spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters with all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." So the men said to her, "Our life for yours, if you do not tell the business of ours. And it shall come about that the Lord gives us the land, when the Lord gives us the land, that we will deal kindly and faithfully with you." Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall, so that she was living on the wall. Now, keep this in mind, because eventually, as we're going to see, the walls of Jericho are going to come crashing down. There's one little spot that's going to remain standing. And obviously, it's the place where Rahab's house is located. "And she said to them, go to the hill country, lest the pursuers happen upon you, and hide yourself there for their 3 days until the pursuers return. Then afterward, you may go on your way. And the men said to her, we shall be free from this oath to you, which you have made us swear, unless when we come into the land, you tie this cord of scarlet thread in the window through which you let us down, gather unto yourself your father and your mother and your brothers and all your father's household." So this is what Rahab did. And then skipping on over now to later on in the account, in chapter 3, we find the Israelites crossing the River Jordan. And in chapter 4, they're commemorating the crossing. Skip all the way over to chapter 5 now, and let's take up the account in verse 9. "Then the Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." The reproach of Egypt refers to the taunts from the Egyptians of how that here you Israelites, you slaves, have gone out and you are going into your land flowing with milk and honey. You were going out into your promised land. Now you've wandered around in the wilderness for 40 years. Can't you find your way? You can imagine what kind of taunts came from the Egyptians as a result of that. But God says, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt. Today you're going into the land. You're going to take the land. So the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day. While the sons of Israel camped at Gilgal, they observed the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month, on the desert plains of Jericho, and on the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten some of the produce of the land, so that the sons of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate some of the yield of the land of Canaan during that year. Of course, they're about to inherit the land, and now they're about to begin their own harvest. At this point, they're eating from other people's harvests. But they're about to take the land, and it's going to be theirs, and they can grow their own crops. Now, there's an interesting story here between this point and the point when they actually go into the land, when they actually go, encircle Jericho. There's an interesting little section of Scripture here, three verses. I'd like to read it to you. I find it most fascinating. Verse 13. Now, it came about when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" And he said, "No." In other words, "Neither. Rather, I indeed come now as the captain of the Lord's army." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and bowed down and said to him, "What has my Lord to say to his servant?" Now, you remember in Revelation 22 how that John fell down before an angel. And the angel said, "No, don't do that. I'm one of your fellow servants, like the prophets. Worship God." You don't find that objection here in the commander of the Lord's army, do you? No, he accepts this worship. Joshua has prostrated himself before this being. Now, notice something else interesting in verse 15. "And the captain of the Lord's host said to Joshua, 'Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy.' And Joshua did so." Does that ring a bell? You remember what Moses was commanded when he approached the burning bush and he heard the voice of God? "Take off your shoes from your feet, for the place on where you, for the place upon which you stand is holy ground." What does this tell us? Nobody's seen the Father. This is not God the Father. It's not an ordinary angel. And yet, obviously, he's deity. I think you know who we're talking about here, don't you? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. That is, he was distinct from God. And yet, the Word was God. He was deity. And this is who you're talking about here. This is none other than he who became Jesus Christ. And now he's there to encourage Joshua. As Joshua prepares to lead the Israelite militia into encircle Jericho and to take that city. And then the account continues in chapter 6, verse 1. "Now Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. No one went out and no one came in. And the Lord said to Joshua," obviously speaking through the commander of the Lord's army now, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand and its king and the valiant warriors. And you shall march around the city, all the men of war, circling the city once. You shall do so for 6 days. Also, seven priests shall carry seven trumpets." You notice the use of this now, the seven trumpets. That sounds familiar too, doesn't it, if you're familiar with the book of Revelation. "Seven priests shall carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. Then on the seventh day, you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And it shall be that when they make a long blast with a ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people will go up, every man straight ahead." So Joshua, the son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let seven priests carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord." To have the Ark of the Lord there, of course, symbolic of God's presence, to let them know that God was with them and that God would see them through this thing. Verse 7, "Then he said to the people, 'Go forward and march around the city, and let the armed men go on before the Ark of the Lord.' And it was so that when Joshua had spoken to the people, the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward and blew the trumpets, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord followed them. And the armed men went before the priests and blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the ark while they continued to blow the trumpets." Obviously, this is designed to perhaps test the Israelites' faith as they continue marching around day after day. Also, the sounds of the trumpets to enhance their faith, and of course to instill fear in the enemies. number of things are going on here. But Joshua commanded the people, saying, "You shall not shout or let your voice be heard, nor let a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I tell you. Shout, then you shall shout." So he had the ark of the Lord taken around the city, circling it once. Then they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. Now Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priest took up the ark of the Lord. And the seven priests, carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord, went on continually and blew the trumpets. And the armed men went before them, and the rear guard came after the ark of the Lord, while they continued to blow the trumpets. Thus the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. They did so for 6 days. Then it came about on the seventh day, and according to Jewish tradition, this day was the Sabbath day. We're not told for sure here, but that's what the Jewish rabbis of old claimed, that this was the Sabbath day when this occurred. They rose early at the dawning of the day and marched around the city in the same manner 7 times. Only on that day they marched around the city 7 times, and it came about at the 7th time, when the priests blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city, and the city shall be under the ban, and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot and all who are with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent." You realize what's happening here? The great and terrible day of the Lord had come to Jericho. The word had gone out to these people. They had heard the message. They knew about the God of Israel. And yet here they are, still in their sins, as it were. But the great and terrible day of the Lord had come to Jericho. Ah, but there are some first fruits of Canaan to come out of this, as we're going to see. As we do see in verse 17, it's the household of Rahab as the first fruits of Canaan. I'll come back to that point a little bit later, but let's continue on in the account. "But as for you, only keep yourselves from things under the ban, lest you covet them and take some of the things under the ban, so you would make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it." This is how God is continually telling the people to stay away from these abominations. It just goes to show you just how abominable the practices must have been in this place. "But all the silver and gold and articles," verse 19, "of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." So the people shouted, and priests blew the trumpets. And it came about, when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, that the people shouted with a great shout. And the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. And they utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep, and donkey with the edge of the sword. They killed everything. Verse 22, "And Joshua said to two men who had spied out the land, 'Go into the harlot's house and bring the woman and all she has out of there, as you have sworn to her.' So the young men who were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all she had. They also brought out all her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel." Why did they do that? Outside the camp of Israel. This was a temporary exclusion, understand. Because you're going to read in a few moments that Rahab lived among the Israelites for the rest of her days. They dwelt outside in this temporary exclusion to be cleansed from the defilement of their natural idolatries. That's why. So they were outside the camp of Israel. You know what this indicates, don't you? It indicates repentance. It indicates change. They didn't continue with this lifestyle. God would not have permitted them, as idolaters, to continue with the people of Israel living among them. It indicated that they changed. They came out of the ways of the Canaanites. They abandoned idolatry and adopted worship of the true God. Verse 24, "And they burned the city with fire and all that was in it. Only the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. However, Rahab the harlot and her family's household and all she had, Joshua spared. And she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day." Means that this book was written. When this book was written, she was still living. She lived in the midst of Israel, not outside the camp, but there in Israel, a Canaanite woman, and of course, her family. For she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Now, you may miss it as you read through this, but really, this gives us a little clue, a little revelation here as to the very purpose of God, His plan, the plan He has for all the world. I'd like for us to go back to Genesis, the 12th chapter. Hold your place here. Go back to Genesis 12 and take a look again at the promise that was given to Abraham. And of course, you know that ultimately this promise points to Jesus Christ, the Messiah. But the promise is inclusive. It includes so many things. And a lot of people think, when they think of Abraham's promise, they think of the Jews. They think of Israel. They think that this somehow is only restricted to the Old Testament and the promises given to the Israelites. But that, of course, is not true, as the Apostle Paul makes very clear in the New Testament. But I'd like if you look at chapter 12, verse 1, what God said to Abraham. He said, "Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. And so shall you be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse him. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." That's the purpose of the Abrahamic promises. It's not just something that pertains to Israel. What he's saying is that the promise given to Abraham of all these multitudes of blessings, and that encompasses many, many things, including ultimately eternal life, but the blessings of inheritance of the land, is to be extended to other nations, other families of the earth. It's not restricted to Israel. And this really is the message throughout the prophets. That's why Isaiah speaks of once Israel is brought back into their ethnic Israel, is brought back into their own land and established as a model nation for the nations of the world, that eventually all the other nations, the families of the earth, will go to Israel and seek to learn of her God. And so what you find here in the example of Abraham is that in that great reservoir, I'm sorry, the example of Rahab, is that then in that great reservoir of blessings contained in the promise to Abraham, you see it tilt just a little bit in the direction of Rahab's house. And had these people, you know, you think about this, you look at this example, you say, wasn't Rahab guilty of treason for abandoning her own people that way? It seems a little bit selfish that she would protect her own and let all these other people perish. But no, understand this, she was not the one who was guilty. We cannot assign guilt to her abandoning the people, because the people of Jericho had great reason to trust in God, just as Rahab had trusted in God. So they were the ones to blame, not Rahab. They knew, all of them knew, that He was God. So had these people trusted God as Rahab had, that great reservoir of blessings that I was talking about that's contained within the promise given to Abraham would have tilted and showered down upon this whole city, and it would have been preserved. People don't think of that when they read over in other scriptures about how a Canaanite shall not enter the house of the Lord. Well, that's later history, and the term Canaanite, just like the word Sodomite, came to mean something other than merely resident of Canaan. It was talking about a kind of character, a type of person, an idolatrous person, a person who was certainly not in accordance with God's law. But here we find very clearly that in the example of Rahab, the fact that God responded to her faith, He would have also responded to the faith of all these other people. And they were really without excuse. They knew He was God. But if they had only followed her example or done what she did, that city would have remained. And it would have been incorporated into Israel. It would have been. Very simple. And thus the blessing of Abraham, to some extent, the blessing that's to be extended to all the families of the earth, would have been received right then and right there by those people. But it was not to be. The name of Rahab go into the records of redemptive history as a shining example of faith. It seems strange, as I said before, that her name would continue to be associated with her former occupation. I guess it just serves to remind us that expressions of faith sometimes come from some of the most unlikely places, doesn't it? Some of the most unlikely places. The name of Rahab finds a place within Hebrews 11. I'd like to also take a look at James, the book of James. If you turn over there. The book of James. He gives honorable mention to this lady. James chapter 2. And here he is talking about the nature of faith, the true nature of faith. And he's talking about Abraham, of course. And then in verse 24, he says, "You see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone." What he means here is a man is justified by faith. Right? That is to say, he's not saying that works justifies a man, but he's saying that the kind of faith that justifies a man is a faith that produces works. And he's using the example of Abraham. And interestingly, right next to Abraham, he says in verse 25, "And in the same way was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way?" In other words, her faith was a faith that produced works. It was not the faith, like the faith of the demons, if you want to call that faith, the belief of the demons, who believed that God is one and trembled. It was not like the faith of her fellow Canaanites, the people of Jericho, who also believed in the God of Israel. They knew what God had done, knew He was God, and trembled, but it didn't produce anything. In the case of Rahab, it did produce works. So this is what James is talking about. But here, once again, we see that Rahab does find a place within Hebrews 11. In those examples of faith, shining examples of faith. And here, in James, she's listed right next to Abraham, the prime example of faith from the point of view of the Old Testament student. It's interesting that she has such an honor, this great honors that are bestowed upon her. But you know, the greatest honor of all is not found in the book of Hebrews or in the book of James, but it's found in Matthew's gospel. I'd like you to turn over there in Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1, and beginning in verse 1, Matthew says, "The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. To Abraham was born Isaac, and to Isaac Jacob, and to Jacob Judah and his brothers. And to Judah were born Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and to Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron Ram. And to Ram was born Amminadab, and to Amminadab Nashon, and to Nashon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz by Rahab." By Rahab. "And to Boaz was born Obed by Ruth, and to Obed Jesse, and to Jesse was born David the king." To the great grandmother of David, beginner of the messianic line, and she finds her place in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. That is the greatest honor bestowed upon Rahab. That's the shining example. That's the outcome of the shining example of faith. So you can see very clearly that Rahab is not one of those lesser examples. If you consider her background, her culture, what she had to deal with, and yet she still believed the God of Israel. She believed that God was the rewarder of those who seek Him. That if one responded to Him in faith, that He would deliver and protect. And indeed, He did. Someday the commander of the Lord's army will once again lead His forces into battle. Once again the trumpets will blast. Once again the commander of the Lord's army will draw His mighty sword, the sword of the Lord. And at the blast of the seventh trumpet, and with the shout, the resounding shout of angelic voice, the walls of this corrupt society will come crashing down. Seeing then that this is coming, the natural question is, what must we do to be saved? What must we do to escape the wrath of God? Is it to find some secret key and find the key of knowledge that will enable us to find the specially elect end-time remnant church? No, and that's not it. Why, who would have guessed it? That the answer to that question could be found in such a simple example as a Canaanite lady a lady named Rahab.